Hello, and welcome to the ParaAqua podcast, the science podcast that shines a light on the newest and most interesting research being conducted in the fields of aquatic and marine ecology. My name is Joe Money. I'm a PhD student and the host of this podcast. Today, I'm joined by Claire Gachon, professor at the French Natural History Museum of Paris. We'll be discussing her research into eukaryotic pathogens, their algal hosts, and the effects that this can have on the emerging algal aquaculture industry. Claire, how are you doing?
Well, really well. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me here this morning. I'm really pleased to be with you.
Not a problem. I'm really glad you could join us. How's your work been recently?
It's been really, really nice, actually. There's been a lot of science. The academic year is starting, so it's very exciting. And we're getting PhD students being recruited.
Yeah, that's a very exciting time of year, isn't it, when a lot of new people are joining, new projects to do. So, Claire, can you give us a quick summary of your background, your education and your research history, just to give a little bit of insight into your interests and your research history?
Sure. I think I grew up in the eastern part of France, so far, far, far away from the sea. And I think really what I was interested into as a kid was nature. I mean, I spent a lot of holidays in the countryside and, you know, I was into insects at first, and then I got into botany and flowers and plants. And I think that really led me quite naturally to study biology and to essentially, I was really interested in how organisms were working, functioning. So what we tend to call physiology. And at some point I moved from the east of France to Paris, to the École Normale Supérieure, where I was appointed as a fellow to pursue my master's. Then I trained as a high school teacher as well, because I was really interested into the diversity of biology as a science and also geology. And then I moved into plant pathology to do my master's, and that was in Strasbourg, so back in the east of France. And then I moved back for my PhD to Paris, working on molecules that would help plants defend themselves against diseases and pathogens. And from that moment, I mean, that was a bit of a change encounter in my life. I sort of got befriended with my partner who was working on algae, and he was in Scotland at the time. So I just moved to Scotland and I changed topic from plants to algae. And that's where I really established a line of research that I've been pursuing ever since, which is diseases of algae and their consequences on, I would say, all aspects. So that could be consequences of the disease on how the algae works, so its physiology. It could be consequences of diseases on ecosystems or on human societies increasingly.
Yeah, wow, that's very cool. That's a very diverse history of your scientific interests. Very cool. And I didn't know that you actually trained to be a teacher. That's very interesting as well.
Yes, I really like my teaching. I mean, unfortunately, I don't do as much teaching as I would love to, because I'm sort of dragged into other things. And the last years has been very administration intensive, because research needs being managed. You know, buildings, people, budgets. I mean, they also need close attention. And I really feel that we have a huge responsibility to put public money to the best possible use. And that's not a trivial thing to do. But I really wish I would have more time for teaching and for passing on knowledge to the next generation.
Yeah, I hear a lot of the same from professors pretty much everywhere you go. I think that they really love their teaching, and it's the administration that takes up more of their time than they'd like. Even during my PhD, I got to do a bit of teaching, and that was one of my favorite parts as well. So I completely understand. So we've talked a little bit about parasitism of algae in previous episodes of this podcast, but could you remind our listeners how algae are parasitized and infected by other diseases and the effect that this can have on marine and aquatic ecosystems?
Sure. I mean, in layman's terms, I mean, you could really say that algae pretty much have every other organism is plagued by diseases. And effectively, organisms that cause diseases are typically our gansons who try to take advantage from the alga or their host more generally, and that means they somehow feed on them or take their energy, and they essentially steal away some energy from the algae. And there are a lot of different organisms that do that. Some of them kill the alga straight away, and we call them pathogens or even parasitoids. And some of them just like, I would say, algae have no blood, but you could say suck the blood out of the algae, and we tend to call them parasites.
Yeah, there's always a bit of uncertainty, I think, sometimes, depending on whether you call that something a pathogen or a parasite or a parasitoid. I think it varies between science, but in this, in the departments that I use, we just sort of refer to even things that kill hosts as parasites. I know that's a bit dubious whether that's completely true, but we just use it to sort of make things clearer. But what sort of parasites or diseases are you particularly looking at?
So, mostly diseases that would have been caused by, I would say, a very diverse group of organisms that we call eukaryotes. So, technically, this would be organisms that have cells with nucleus. So, I would say everything except bacteria and viruses would fall into this category. And that really encompasses an extremely broad range of different pathogens and parasites. The ones I've mostly worked on, but not exclusively, would be cousins of the mildews. So the ones that grow on potato, the potato blight, and the grape mildew. That's really, I'd say, where the core of my research has been. But I've worked over the years on many other different types of organisms and species.
Nice. So, although we work with different species, we actually share a similar direction in our research because we're both working with what are called model systems. Could you outline what a model system is and explain why these systems are so important for science as a whole, and in particular, how this is applied in your algal parasitism research?
Right. A model system is a biological system. So I would say for us who work on diseases, it's typically a host and a pathogen that causes disease on that host. And the model is one that we chose because it's somehow convenient or practical to address a biological question. And when we say convenient, it means that it is adapted to the question that we're asking ourselves, but it's also one that we can work on in the lab somehow, so that technically is, I would say, the easiest we can think of in order to address the question. And that's very similar to what other researchers are doing in other fields, for example, lab rats in animal biology, fruit fly genetics. You tend to choose an organism that has specific characteristics. For example, for the fruit fly, it's very short reproduction time. That makes it very easy for you to make crosses and to look at what's happening for the next generation. That's exactly what we're doing with algae and parasites.
Nice. And is there a specific species or two species that form this model system for your research?
Originally, I focused on one brown alga, which was the first one for which the entire DNA sequence was decrypted. That was called Ictocarpus silicosus, and that was the first alga, big alga, for which we had this information available. But then over the years, as I broadened the research questions I got interested in, so from big macroalgae, the multicellular algae, down to phytoplankton, reaching out to applied research, I think you want to talk about later, I broadened essentially the number of species that we worked on in the lab. In fact, I think my trademark as a researcher is to establish new models. So, to bring new species in the lab, both algae and pathogens, to address questions that we think are worth researching.
That's great. That's great. That must be very exciting when you finally, or at least, have a candidate model system that you really want to put
I
forward
find
and
it actually totally amazing. That's why somehow it's I mean, I never planned this, but this is kind of exactly why I end up in a natural history museum, which, you know, the remit of which is to study biodiversity and the interaction between nature and human environment. It's literally because, you know, I get interested into so many different species of algae and parasites. And there's so many facets to it that, you know, there is not one particular model that would be adapted to answering all these questions that we have.
Yeah, I guess you need a diversity of models, even though you're focusing on specific
Yes.
organisms, you still need a diversity, I guess.
Absolutely.
So one of the things we briefly spoke about before recording is that the effect that microorganisms can have on the outcomes of infections in algal species. Could you elaborate a bit on the role of the microbiome in this system? I know you've mentioned that you mainly focus on eukaryotic parasites, but it would be interesting to see how the prokaryotic world influences those infections.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the most recent projects that we've been pursuing. Effectively, so as I was explaining, typically what we have in the lab is an alga and a eukaryotic parasites. But what we also realized, and especially for a green algal species of commercial interest called Haematococcus, was that the bacteria that are associated naturally to this green alga, so that, you know, we try to grow commercially. These bacteria have an influence on how the alga is able to defend itself or not against a fungal pathogen. And that has really triggered research recently in my lab to actually look at how these bacteria were influencing the outcome of an infection and whether we could actually engineer this consortia of bacteria associated to the alga in order to promote growth and resistance to pathogen attack.
Nice. Yeah, it's a very hot topic, I feel like, even in the human world, the microbiome, people talking about their gut health, their all of these things that actually have more of an impact on their life than they'd think. And it's fascinating to think that that even applies at such a small micro level with algae and parasites.
Yes, it is. It is very, very hot topic at the moment. And I think this is something that these interactions with known, I mean, you know, scientists knew for ages that they were potentially very important. But I think what has been really unlocking that discipline is really technological advances, especially advances with the capacity to analyze the molecules produced by these communities, but also with DNA sequencing. That really means that this world of exploring bacterial communities associated to the algal host and the pathogen was previously totally, sorry, inaccessible to us. And now suddenly this world can be revealed, and that's really what we're now very keen on exploring.
Does this have any relation to your earlier work studying sort of plant pathogens? You mentioned that you were working on maybe terrestrial plant diseases, and I know that the soil microbiome is a big factor for agriculture and sort of monitoring these outbreaks of diseases. Is there any sort of crossover or analogies that you can draw between these sort of terrestrial infections and the marine infections?
So there are analogies. I did not work on them at the time because I started working on plant biology before all this next generation sequencing was available. So before microbiome studies in plants took off. But what is extremely interesting in algae and that is really echoed in plants is that what we realize is that cultivation of plants and cultivation of algae is actually drastically altering the structure and the functioning of the associated bacteria. And that also has an impact on how these plants and algae are able to defend themselves against infection. And that's really something that is starting to really be well described in plants. So that plant domestication also involves domestication of the associated microbes, and that we are just starting to scratch on the surface with algae. And that's really where we are at the moment.
So I'm not that well versed in terrestrial like a agriculture and these sort of plant sciences, but is there a future or is it even the current practice to sort of introduce on purpose into the soil certain bacterial strains, certain symbiotic
There is, yes, there
organisms.
is. And it's called, it's a huge field. It's essentially called biocontrol. And this is actually really something that is actively, intensively researched nowadays. It's as an alternative to chemical treatments and spraying pesticides and fungicides and all sorts of things, where I think everybody sees, the limits of this strategy of using chemicals for controlling diseases, which, I mean, in a way, has been very successful in the second half of the 20th century, but also comes with its own environmental problems, which I think are now apparent to everybody.
That's very interesting, actually, because I am a bit familiar with the phrase biological control, but I've sort of more applied it to let's say the introduction of sort of symbiotic animals or predators of pests for agriculture than I have for the introduction of soil bacteria. So that's very interesting that that is maybe the next stage of biological
Well,
control.
it already does happen, and I think this is really something that people are very, very keen on trying to understand better. There is also a huge drive at the moment to also look at the wild microbiomes of plants that have not been domesticated. So there is a huge drive at the moment to look at the microbiome of wild relatives of plants that have not been domesticated to actually rewild, as say, microbiomes of crops in order to try to increase their resistance potentially to diseases. And from an evolutionary perspective, what is fascinating is that actually plants naturally tend to recruit bacteria or members of microbes that are beneficial to them. So there are these symbioses that are actually establishing themselves and are already present, naturally occurring. Microbes that plants actually garden and nurture around themselves that help them resist against infection. And these are really this type of interactions that a lot of people are trying to untangle in order to then exploit in with an agronomical perspective.
That's great. That's very, very fascinating and hopefully beneficial going forward. Okay, Claire. So we talked a little bit about the sort of biological and pathological impact of parasites and diseases on algae, but what are the impacts of algal parasites and diseases on the natural ecosystems that our listeners might be familiar with? Are there any regulatory or detrimental effects of these parasites and diseases?
Right, that's a very good question. I guess the short answer is like, yes, this impact is presumably massive, and we're only starting to understand it. I think one of the determining factor that drove me to realize that was, again, when sequencing really became more widespread than it is, and really when we started to be able to sequence in bulk and do some DNA fingerprinting of either freshwater bodies or marine bodies. Fundamentally, what a lot of people started to find independently, both in marine and freshwater environments, was that parasites were dominating the water bodies where algae were. So essentially, wherever you had algae, you really had a lot of parasites around. And modeling sort of really suggested time and over again that parasites had probably a similar effect to grazers in controlling the populations of algae. They're removing a lot of the algal biomass, which is the bottom of the food chain, probably at the same rate as grazers would take. So that's really a massive impact. And then what also became really obvious at the time was that most of these parasites were not described. So nobody even knew they existed before these sequencing studies took place. So it's really been, I would say, a major finding of the last decade or so. It is that parasites of algae are massively present. We see their DNA signature in all sorts of freshwater and marine environments, but they have been so understudied that we really don't really know what they are or what they look like. And there is like this massive work that remains to be done, which is really to describe them and to just like, give them a name so that we can know, if we go from one place and another place at the two different times, there is the same thing that is occurring, whether they are two different things, like two different species. And this is one of the reasons why, again, I end up naturally in a natural history museum, because this is really what natural history museums do. This is a science, it's called taxonomy. It is really about describing the biodiversity, and that has become really, really massively relevant for parasites of algae.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. It's crazy to think that the sort of herbivorous grazers that we associate with natural terrestrial landscapes are sort of being replaced, I guess, by parasites in the marine and aquatic systems as a sort of form of keeping the algal populations under control. That's very interesting indeed. So, Claire, I've seen from your resume that you have experience as a consultant scientist for companies aiming to manufacture products using algal biotechnology. This is something we briefly touched upon a little bit before in the podcast, but how can studying these various interactions between host, parasite, and microorganisms benefit the rapidly growing algal aquaculture industry?
Well, I guess that it's the algal industry has really been booming. So both the cultivation of phytoplankton species and the cultivation of what we call macroalgae, so multicellular algae that are usually more associated with coastal marine environments like kelps or red algae from which you would extract jellyfying products. In any case, diseases and parasites, as I say, they are everywhere in nature. And they also enter algal production systems, whatever the system is. So whether it's a photobioreactor on land or whether it's, a seaweed farm that would be in the open sea. And fundamentally, the more you try to grow seaweed, the more you hit the problem of losing crop or decreasing crop quality because of some parasite or pathogen infection. And this problem of diseases has been growing really at the same pace as the algal industry, and that is exponentially over the last decades as well. And now it's become really big. So we're having a number of difficulties. The first one is, as I was saying before, is that we're just realizing how diverse and unknown pathogens of algae are. So typically, the diseases are being discovered as the algae are trying to be produced commercially. So it is not unheard of, and this is actually happening all the time, that when farmers try to produce algae, they will just have some unknown disease, outbreak in the farm. And we're effectively at the stage where we're just like coming as scientists and essentially trying to understand what these organisms are in the farms that cause outbreaks. And from that understanding, we try to derive very quickly as we can, and that can still take years, try to understand how we could possibly manage them to reduce their impact on the production. And then the second big problem that we're having is around the movement of algae around the world, and the fact that this algae might be infected with pathogens that nobody knows are around, but still are lurking around. As the algae are moved around the world, they could be also moved with the pathogens, who could then be introduced in new areas. And there are examples in other industries. I'm thinking about oyster industry, the salmon industry, the shrimp industry, where actually moving around the host organism has really wreaked havoc in farms all around the world, but also on natural population, because there's been incidental introductions of pathogens. And this is also something that we're actively trying to research in order to assess the risk and, as I guess, propose management measures that allow the industry to function whilst minimizing the risk to the environment and the risk to farmers.
See, so when you say the movement of algae around the world, you're talking about introduction via human agriculture and transportation across borders and stuff like that,
Yes,
right?
I am, which is at the moment pretty much unregulated. And
Wow.
this is really something that is very striking compared to plant and animal agriculture, is that if you would want to move around plants or animals for agricultural purpose, you essentially have to prove to authorities that they are free of diseases. We essentially have the same problem with seaweed. Essentially, we do not have any international authority that would be responsible for establishing the standards around diseases, the ones that would have to be monitored and the ones that we could afford not to monitor. And we're at the stage where we have massive outbreaks, for example, in tropical countries, where we don't even know what the causative organism is. So it's scientifically impossible to regulate about a disease that you don't even know what the causing agent is.
Yeah, that's really interesting and kind of worrying. But is there any of this biocontrol methods that we talked about earlier, using the bacteria or using the microbiome to sort of insulate the algae against these sort of pathogen attacks?
Ultimately, I would love to say yes. I think apart from perhaps a few species and perhaps the green algae that I was talking about, which is potentially grown in photobioreactors, a closed environment where we could try to control and manipulate the associated bacterial flora. I don't think we're anywhere near controlling the bacteria associated to seaweeds grown in the open sea, especially in developing countries where most of the cultivation takes place. So theoretically, yes, that might be a prospect. In practice, we're just nowhere near being able to implement such solutions. We don't know what the solution is, and it's really a major challenge already to have access to the farms, to the farmers who might be poor, who might have sometimes very little education in some countries. Developing countries where most of the cultivation takes place, the farmers and the professionals are very removed from these microbiome types of studies. And really, their concern is about improving yield, it is about increasing production to have an income, usually for families and coastal communities, which typically tend to be deprived. And what we need to design for them is really simple solutions and very practical solutions. Also considering that we have a lot of the diseases that are favored by global warming, and that it's really tricky to, we cannot just take the disease in isolation. We need to understand how the farms function, and we also need to take into account other factors such as climate change.
Sounds like a challenge, but at least a very interesting area of research going forward, perhaps.
Thank you.
So, finally, Claire, we briefly mentioned that you are working at the Natural History Museum in Paris. So, I couldn't finish the interview without mentioning at least one question about this, because I count myself amongst many scientists, I presume, who have always dreamed of working at a museum of natural history. And so I had to, of course, ask you how it is. And more importantly, have you ever been able to sneak around the exhibits in the evening when all the tourists have gone home and basically just use it as your own personal playground, I guess?
No, unfortunately, that only ever happens in movies, being locked up in the museum. So I can only think of Mr. and Mrs. Brown and the Paddington movie being locked up in London and running after this crazy taxidermist that wants to kill Paddington.
Yeah, I was thinking of some Scooby-Doo sort of, childhood book maybe of these children getting locked in the museum.
It happens in cartoon movies, but not in real life. Perhaps it only happened a few months ago, actually. We had an Extinction Rebellion a protest that was staged with actually some scientists that organized to be locked up in the paleontology gallery and to ch chain themselves to I think a mammoth, and trying to bring attention of the general public to the fact that, you know, there is this massive extinction crisis going on, and that really stirred a bit of a fuss about that.
Yeah, I can imagine because I mean it's a very worthy cause, but I can also kind of think that maybe they just wanted to spend some more time in the Natural History Museum.
Yeah, I mean it's a you know, they're trying to attract attention, and basically the argument that was made, which I mean you could sort of try to understand, is that they're saying it's a public service mission that we have to, as researchers in the museum, to actually send a message to the general public by any possible line that, you know, we really are having a big problem with this biodiversity crisis.
Yeah, very understandable indeed. Very understandable. So, Claire, I think we've come to the end of the interview now, but I really enjoyed talking to you. Some very interesting discussions happened, I think. Yeah, thanks again for coming on. And yeah, I hope good luck with all your future research as well.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's been really my pleasure to be here this morning.
The Para Aqua podcast was funded by COST, the European Cooperation in Science and Technology, and is a product of the Para Aqua Action Group. If you are interested in joining an action group or just want to know more, please go to www.paraaqua-cost.eu or follow the link in the episode description. The podcast is produced by myself and Serena Rasconi, and the Science Communication Coordinator is Anna Gavrilovich. Once again, thanks for listening and see you next time on the Para Aqua podcast.